Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Welcome back to the Stronger by Science podcast. We are back from our summer break and better than ever. As always, we've got some really impressive feats of strength. We've got some great research reviews covering several studies over the last couple months. We've got some very helpful barbecue tips now that football season is in full swing. And we've got some huge announcements. We have a new Facebook group and a new subreddit, and those are going to allow you to join in on the Stronger by Science conversation. So without further ado, let's jump into the first episode of season 3. Welcome back to the Stronger by Science podcast. This is your host, Eric Trexler. We are back from summer break, and we are better than ever. For this first episode back from summer break, I've got a very special temporary guest co-host. His name's Greg Knuckles. Greg, how was your summer break?
It was fine, I guess. I don't really have any superlatives for it, mostly just cooped up in the house, lifting a lot, cooking a lot. But yeah, it was fine. How was yours?
It was good. Did a bunch of writing, which was enjoyable. So some of that stuff will be coming out in the future, which is very good. But hey, I'm excited to be back. I kind of missed recording, to be honest.
Yeah. It's going to be fun. The boys are back, baby.
The boys are back in town, but not exactly the same. We got some big changes that occurred over the summer break. So a couple things to keep people up to date on. First of all, one of the biggest things is now there are official designated spots on the internet where you can discuss the show, but really all things Stronger by Science. We wanted to kind of designate some online spaces for people to talk about the show, but also just talk about articles that come out, questions people have for us. So we created a public Facebook group that people can join. It is called the Stronger by Science Community, so you can easily find that on Facebook. We also created a subreddit. So if you go to reddit.com/r/StrongerByScience, that is now the Stronger by Science subreddit. So Greg and I get a lot of messages from people, which we're always happy to receive, always happy to respond to, but we figured it would make sense to have an open public place where we could answer those questions, talk about the show, and talk about basically everything going on in the Stronger by Science cinematic universe. So Greg, you're going to be in charge of the subreddit because I don't understand how to use Reddit, but I'm going to learn. That is my commitment. It's on the air, and now it's set in stone. Another big change is we have to add a new segment. We haven't come up with a title yet. We only had a summer to think of it, but we could go with the classic being Obscene Profit Timeout. That might be one. We could call it the Selling Out segment or the Cashing In segment. We'll workshop it, post in the community, let us know what you think. But the big news is we now have a sponsor.
We do.
For the first time ever.
Yeah, so I am not entirely sure why they reached out to me specifically, probably just because I do use their products. But bulksupplements.com reached out and said like, hey, would you have any interest in being a brand ambassador? And I said pretty much like, no, I don't like the whole vibe of brand ambassador. That just seems weird to me. But I am occasionally a temporary guest co-host on a podcast. Would you be interested in sponsoring the podcast? And they said, sure. And so we've been thinking about maybe getting a sponsor or like trying to get a sponsor for the podcast for a bit because it is not monetized in any way. But we weren't really sure how to go about that, specifically just because like we didn't want to feel like we were selling out super hard. And like, so for example, bulksupplements.com just sells, you know, individual ingredients that you could buy yourself and mix together. We're comfortable with that, but like a few supplement companies asked if they could sponsor the podcast, and we said no, just because we didn't want to feel like we were beholden to them in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, you know, like they put a dumb combination of ingredients in a product, and now you feel like, oh, should we say that that's a dumb combination of ingredients? You know what I mean?
Yeah. So yeah, I've been using Bulk Supplements as the way that I acquire bulk supplements for a long time. I can't remember the last time I actually bought a branded supplement product, except for Athlete Vitamin from Citadel Nutrition. It's good. But yeah, for the most part, like if I want creatine, if I want citrulline malate, I don't buy caffeine powder because I learned how dangerous that was. I used to, wouldn't recommend it. But yeah, let's see, when I was playing around with beta alanine, like I get all of my stuff from bulk supplements just because they have good prices. And, you know, if I'm buying from some other company, I don't know if it's, if they're like underdosing supplements. There's always a huge, huge markup. So, I mean, bulk supplements has high quality stuff at good prices. So, like, I've been using them for a long time. And so I didn't feel as ethically compromised agreeing to that sponsorship as I probably would for many other.
Yeah. So, if you go to bulksupplements.com and during the checkout, you enter the code SBSPOD, SBSPOD, you will get
all caps.
You will get 5% off your order. And so think of it this way, Greg. If you, let's say you spend in a given year $2.5 million on supplements. Well, I'm not saying that's like the median amount that most people spend. I'm just saying, for instance.
So yeah, I mean, this is a classic like mean versus median, like
exactly.
You know, yeah. What measure of central tendency to use. We assume that for our listeners, the median is closer to about $1 million, $1.5 million. But yeah, mean probably around $2.5 million.
So if you're spending $2.5 million per year, you're using this code, you're going to save $125,000 per year. And depending on your real estate market, that's buying a house just from like 2 to 4 years of supplement savings. I mean, that's huge. So 5% off your order, SBS Pod. And if you're a different company and you'd like to rent our loyalty and credibility for a shockingly low price, hit us up. Maybe you'll get added to this segment.
Sounds good.
Okay, let's move on. We've got a good news segment. So Greg, why don't you kick us off there?
Yeah, so I struggled to find a good news thing, but I did find one. So well,
that defeats the whole purpose of the segment. Saying,
well, there are good things that are happening. They're just difficult to find.
Okay.
I looked for a fucking diamond in the rough. What more do you expect from me? Anyway, so I went to something that's very near and dear to my heart. Two things, actually, which are bears and bulking. So the bears of the world are about to go into hibernation. And so it seems like the fine bears at Katmai National Park have completed their summer and autumn bulking seasons successfully. And so in order to give them kind of the praise and recognition they deserve for their successful bulks, explore.org has a competition. It's a fat bear competition where you can vote on which bears most successfully bulked over the summer and autumn. By the time this podcast comes out, Fat Bear Week will have concluded 2 days prior. So you'll probably be listening to this on Thursday. Fat Bear Week finished up on Tuesday. But if you just go to explore.org/meet-the-bears, you can check out all of the bears and how fat they got. And yeah, I feel good for those bears. Fun fact, let's talk about hibernation for like 5 minutes, because I think people don't understand hibernation. I know I certainly didn't. I remember like learning about it in elementary or middle school biology class that like, hey, here's this thing bears do. They get in their den and it's nice and cozy and they pretty much just snooze and just generally vibe for a few months. That's not the case at all. Dude, hibernation sounds like it fucking sucks. I was listening to an NPR segment with someone from the Duke Lemur Center, because apparently fat-tailed lemurs hibernate as well, and they store their fat to hibernate in their tail. And like, dude, animals are not vibing at all when they're hibernating. Essentially, the process of hibernation is you take endothermic animals that, you know, regulate their body temperature via metabolic activity, slow the metabolic activity way, way down so they don't starve over winter. But then it's basically just a tug of war between starving to death and freezing to death. And so they actually sleep for virtually none of the time. They're awake pretty much straight for several months with just small little naps interspersed. And they're walking a tightrope between doing a little activity to get some metabolic activity so they don't freeze to death and trying to move as little as possible so they don't starve to death. And basically, it just sounds like the most miserable process. And also, thing about bears, so other animals that hibernate, like lemurs, generally find dens to get into so they'll be safe and not get attacked during their hibernating. But apparently, a lot of bears don't even find dens. So, like, a fair amount of them do, but since in most environments they are the apex predator, it's not uncommon for bears to just kind of decide, like, hey, my autumn bulk is done, it's hibernating time, and just fucking lay down in the middle of a field because they know no one's gonna mess with them, and they just hibernate there for like 4 months, which that is pretty cool.
Yeah, so overall, you, for listeners who are looking for practical takeaways, you'd say just like don't hibernate?
That would be my recommendation.
Very cool. So in my installment of the good news segment here, we're sticking with the animals theme. Humans just aren't generating a lot of good news. You hate to say it, but humanity is, it's on the back burner for now. We're focusing on the animals.
Yeah. Man, if I could just say like one more kind of depressing thing to bring down the mood during the good news segment. So I think making the good news segment does actively harm my mental health because like, dude, we go on these websites. There are like good news curated websites for, I guess, people who want uplifting things to see about and, like, you know, pick themselves up in dark times. But like most of the good news, like, pieces of content on those sites are just severely dystopian.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, there's some kid who has some sort of, you know, major medical issue who's going to fucking die because their parents don't have insurance, and like, you know, it's either let the kid fucking die or go in like six figures of debt. But oh man, their classmates pulled together and ran a bake sale to like allow them to get this treatment they needed. It's like, on one hand, you know, good for the classmates. That is nice. It shows humanity pulling together. But like, the whole fucking premise of the story wouldn't exist if a lot of shit hadn't gone wrong on the front end. Like,
yeah.
Both the fact that the kid has some sort of like major medical issue, and two, the fact that our medical system basically puts people in a gambit of like let kids fucking die or put families in debt for generations. Like, I feel like on the whole, that's not good news.
It's so, unfortunately, I'm playing right into your hand here.
Oh no. Oh no.
So my good news starts with some bad news. No, but this is a great example. And believe it or not, I doubt you did enough prep for the show to read my good news link here.
Oh, I absolutely did not.
So, Talaqua, I think, was a whale, is a whale, who had in 2018, she was all over the news. She had a little baby whale. It passed away. It was very sad. People all over the world were watching. But she has a new baby, a new healthy baby. So it was a very sad story. Everybody was kind of grieving with this poor whale mom who lost her baby. But she had a new baby. Mother and baby are doing well. So it's a nice little feel-good story. But one of the reasons I had to use this is it's kind of a personal story for me. So, Greg, if you were to think of a word to describe me, what would it be? Sophisticated.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. So, sophisticated gentleman that I am, a couple years ago, I took a nice young woman on a date. It was a cool date. We went to an art exhibit, and it was collaborations between an artist and a scientist doing art exhibits based on the science they do. So like a lot of cool imaging work that had been kind of, you know, biomedical imaging would be given to an artist to kind of put their creative spin on it. There's a lot of ocean stuff, a lot of really cool ocean stuff. And I was like, oh, you know what we should do? We should watch an episode of that. I think it was called Blue Earth.
Yeah.
And I had never seen it, but I was like, look at these cool, beautiful ocean things. That would be a cool thing to do. So it was the second date with this person. And there was a very emotional whale scene in Blue Earth that I didn't know was there. And so, you know, second date with somebody, you're thinking, okay, still got to make a good impression. Hopefully there will be a third date, right? What you don't want to do is look over during date number two and see tears. She was crying because of this really sad whale scene very similar to Tahlequah's initial 2018 ordeal. So I was like, this is not going well. I was not certain if there'd be a third date because tears are not a good thing. But there was a third date and many more. It's actually my current girlfriend. So that was a couple years ago, still going strong. But I owe her a positive story about a whale and a baby. And this is the positive whale and baby story.
Nice.
So now we're even. All good.
Yeah, that's good to hear.
Okay.
That's not nearly as dark and dystopian as the stuff I was talking about.
No.
I'm always good with like...
It was a sad thing.
I'm good with like a happy animal story or like an animal redemption story. Like whatever. That's cool.
Okay. So let's move on to humans for a small amount of time here.
Let's do it.
With the rest of the show. What about feats of strength? We've been gone for a while. Certainly people have continued to lift weights.
Yeah, they have. In the outline, you specifically told me to limit myself to 1 to 3 total. So this is a relatively short feats of strength segment and pretty recent stuff. So Joe Sullivan recently set the all-time squat world record in the 100 kilo class or 220 pound class without wraps. So he squatted 373 kilos or 822 pounds. That beats Amit Sapir's previous record by half a kilo or about a pound. I think we've talked about some of Amit's previous records and questionable depth in relation to Kevin Oak breaking some of his other records. The previous 220 record was not as much of an utter shit show as like the 242 record that Amit held was, but it was also questionable. Joe's depth, on the other hand, was flawless. He buried it. Really, really, really great lift. So kudos to Joe. The other one is Tomas Hautala. I think he's... Oh, man, I should have noted this. I think he's Swedish. He competes in IPF, in the IPF affiliates, as far as I'm aware. That's what his most recent comps have been in. And he pulled 400 kilos or 881 pounds at a body weight of 106 kilos or 234 pounds, which is crazy impressive. He seems like he's made a lot of progress. His best previous pull in a meet is 370 kilos or 815 pounds. So that's substantial progress for someone who's already that strong. And if he were to pull 400 kilos in the IPF, that would tie for the third biggest drug-tested pull of all time. And the only two people who have pulled more in a tested competition are Mark Henry and Mikhail Kokhlyov, which I'll note, I didn't know that Kokhlyov ever competed drug-tested. That one surprised me a little bit. I'm not going to elaborate on that further. But anyway, a 400-kilo deadlift... It's fucking strong, regardless of how someone competes or how much they weigh. But the fact that he competes tested and he only weighs 106 kilos, crazy, crazy impressive deadlift.
Good stuff. All right. So during our break, a lot of research happened. It just kept pushing forward. The science never stops.
It did.
And so for that reason, we want to do a research roundup segment. Got quite a few studies to talk about here, so each one we're going to keep it pretty brief, just do a little snapshot just to keep the people updated about what kind of science is happening. So I'm going to kick things off here. I was looking through, we do the journal sweep every month for MAST, kind of choosing what what articles we're going to write each month. And so when I was looking through the list of articles that came out, I saw one about cannabis consumption. And I was pretty interested in it because I was hoping that maybe there would be some glimpses of like some CBD type interventions, you know, because CBD oil is everywhere and there's just really not much research on it. I was hoping maybe there'd be something about chronic training adaptations in there. But this study specifically looked...
Or just scientific proof that marijuana usage is the peak of moral depravity.
Yeah, and there really wasn't anything in there about moral depravity whatsoever, which I don't know who reviewed it. I don't know who the editor was, but you want to tell both sides of that if you're going to do science.
That's a major oversight.
Yeah, but anyway, it just specifically looked at the acute effects of cannabis consumption on exercise performance. So what was really surprising is that there's just not a lot of research on this. I guess it shouldn't be that surprising. It's pretty difficult to get permission to do that.
There's not a ton of exercise research on crack cocaine.
That's true.
And the two are very similar.
To some, yes. But anyway, so they had 8 peer-reviewed publications that they looked at in the systematic review, and 10 literature reviews. So it's one of those things people like... People like writing about it, but it's hard to actually do the research on it. You know,
it's like BFR research circa 2013.
Yeah, like 4 studies and 19 narrative reviews.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, there's people are interested in it, but there's just not that much primary original research to go with. But they looked at those studies that were available, and it makes sense. You know, like I think after the 80s specifically in the United States, if you're trying to get the IRB to approve it, like it just wasn't going to happen.
Yeah.
So in this systematic review, they looked at studies that included 2 different delivery routes, either inhalation of the THC or oral ingestion of the THC. So edible THC interventions. So the results basically showed that cannabis consumption prior to exercise was unfavorable for performance. So subjects were had a reduced ability to maintain their effort and to maintain physical, maximal work capacity during exercise. And there were some undesirable physiological responses as well. So heart rate and breathing rate were increased. Myocardial oxygen demand was increased at a given intensity of exercise. And those aren't favorable things when it comes to the physiological responses to exercise. And then there were some neurological effects as well that influenced balance. So there was at least one study looking at sway that I recall. So some of the neuromuscular control was just a little bit skewed. So based on the articles in this review, and again, it's a very small body of literature, unsurprisingly, they basically said, hey, pre-exercise cannabis consumption, probably not a great idea. I'd still be really interested to see. It's one of those questions we get a lot where people are like, hey, I enjoy using cannabis. It's legal where I live. So, you know, leave me alone. But is it really going to impair my gains over time if, you know, in the evening I'm consuming it? And, you know, none of the studies in this systematic review would really give any useful information for that question, but it definitely seems inadvisable to use THC directly prior to exercise. So in this study, they were looking at exercise that occurred anywhere from 20 to about 200 minutes after the THC was ingested. So within those couple hours before exercise, it definitely looks like THC use is not advisable. One thing to keep in mind is that this systematic review might have even underestimated the unfavorable responses. The reason being, a lot of these studies were published between 1974 and 1986. And so the authors mentioned that at that time, the THC dosage in a single joint that would be used in this type of study was between 5 and 25 milligrams of THC. But times have changed, Greg. So a THC concentration in a joint today might be as high as like 150 milligrams per joint. And so for
just another reason that society is going to hell in a handbasket. Unbelievable.
Exactly. So it's quite possible, you know, this systematic review found some unfavorable physiological effects acutely after THC consumption, some unfavorable effects on performance. It's possible that the effects are even more unfavorable, given the fact that the THC dosage per unit of cannabis has really kind of skyrocketed since these studies occurred. And again, this is purely looking at consuming it directly before exercise or within an hour or two beforehand. So this is not, this really has no bearing on whether or not THC or cannabis can be utilized. It's just, can it be utilized effectively before a workout? And the answer seems to be probably not.
Yeah, I think what you touched on with this body of literature being incomplete due to the dosages being used, I think that's a good point. Another thing that I think is very unfortunate that it hasn't been looked into yet is like you said, they've looked at things like changes in heart rate and breathing rate and myocardial oxygen demand. I think it's pretty unfortunate that they haven't looked at the effects of THC on strength, because I mean, if I know anything about the effects of marijuana from the documentary film Reefer Madness, it can just make people fly into a rage and exhibit super physiological strength levels.
Yeah.
So I think that research is definitely needed on that.
I just find it disappointing. Every time that you talk trash on marijuana, we get like 96 negative ratings on iTunes. So we finally make the leap. We've got a sponsor now. It's quite an industrious enterprise we've got going here, and you drive it into the ground.
I mean, once bulk supplements start selling THC powder, I might change my tune.
No, all right.
to be clear to our listeners, it's a bit.
It's just a bit.
All right. So a recent study came out by Norum and colleagues, titled "Caffeine Increases Strength and Power Performance in Resistance-Trained Females During Early Follicular Phase." And this is... The results are basically what one would expect. So we've talked about caffeine on the podcast quite a bit before. There's, I don't know, probably like 8 or 10 different meta-analyses showing basically that caffeine improves virtually all aspects of anaerobic performance. So one rep max strength, strength endurance, isometric strength, isokinetic strength, power output. So it tends to have like pretty modest effects on all of those things, but they seem to be, you know, consistently and meaningfully positive. One of the drawbacks is that virtually all of the research looking at the effect of caffeine on anaerobic performance and strength performance specifically has used exclusively male subjects. So, you know, we've talked about before how the resistance training literature does tend to be pretty male biased in terms of subject pools, but caffeine research is substantially more slanted towards male subjects than the literature as a whole. And so it was good to see this study in female lifters. So they did a crossover study, placebo-controlled. Subjects took either a placebo or 4 mg/kg of caffeine before exercise, and then, you know, 50-50 to start with, and then after a washout period, the people who took the placebo first took caffeine and vice versa. And they were looking at the effect on counter movement jump height, squat 1RM, squat reps to failure with 60% of 1RM, bench 1 rep max, bench reps to failure, and several other things, but those were the outcomes that I was the most interested in. And all of those things increased. All of the increases were, again, as one would expect looking at the previous literature, pretty modest, so trivial to small effect sizes, but significant effects in favor of caffeine consumption. One thing to note is that a lot of the studies in this area have used subjects who weren't habitual caffeine consumers, or who were low habitual caffeine consumers. The subjects in this study actually, on average, used a bunch of caffeine. you know, just in day-to-day life. So one of the things the authors did was to look to see if habitual caffeine consumption was associated with the ergogenicity of caffeine for their various outcome measures. And they found that with the exception of reps to failure, habitual caffeine consumption didn't seem to affect how much caffeine usage outperformed placebo. So basically, you know, it could be that people who are habitual caffeine users may not get as much of a ergogenic strength endurance effect from using caffeine before workouts. But otherwise, like, regardless of whether you don't use caffeine or you do habitually use quite a bit of caffeine, caffeine does still seem to be ergogenic for most outcomes. Another thing to note about this study, since it did use female athletes, is they specifically collected data during the early follicular phase of the menstrual cycle. That's important because one of the things about caffeine is there are reasons to suspect that the effects of caffeine on exercise performance might be different between the sexes, mostly because estrogen affects caffeine metabolism. And the early follicular phase is, you know, during menses or maybe up to a couple days post menses if a woman has like relatively short menses. And during the early follicular phase, both estrogen and progesterone levels are quite low. So it could be that there might still be sex differences in exercise performance, or like the effects of caffeine on exercise performance if it was measured at some other point in the menstrual cycle when estrogen and or progesterone levels are higher. So that's something to note, and, you know, something to hopefully look for follow-up research on. And another thing to note about this study, just kind of a statistical point, is some of the results of this study are good examples of p-values being influenced by both magnitude and consistency. So someone might pull up the full text of the study and look and see that there was a significant increase in bench press performance when people use caffeine instead of a placebo pre-workout. But the actual mean values for both conditions were 66 kilos for placebo and 68 kilos for caffeine. And someone might look at that and say, that's only a 2 kilo increase. How could that be significant? Especially, you know, since this study didn't have like 500 subjects or something. And that's because p-values are determined both by magnitude and consistency of effects. And so this study shows the individual results. And I think one subject had no difference between the caffeine and placebo conditions, and every other subject benched somewhere between 1 and 4 kilos more when they use caffeine than when they use the placebo. So it was a very, very consistent effect. It was a small effect, but it was very consistent. And so like that's still worthwhile. And that tells you, you know, if something has like a large mean effect, but it's super variable, it might be great for some people and actually bad for other people. But in the case of caffeine, it seems to have relatively consistent effects. If you take so much that it makes you like freak out and get super jittery, it might be ergolytic. But otherwise, it's probably going to either have no effect or a small positive effect. And so, yeah, like knowing both the magnitude and consistency of an effect, I think is pretty important. And both of those things go into a p-value.
Yeah, it is crazy with the caffeine literature. There was a paper by Del Coso a couple years ago that was highlighting the discrepancy of male versus female participant representation within the caffeine literature.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember the proportion off the top of my head, but I'm pretty sure it was like 80-20. Like it was pretty lopsided. So whenever you see another paper come out, particularly when it comes to anaerobic outcomes, it's always good to see more research being done on caffeine specifically in female subjects. Okay, moving on. I found a really cool paper. The title was Appetitive Traits as Targets for Weight Loss, the Role of Food Cue Responsiveness and Satiety Responsiveness. And the whole idea here was looking at these different appetite-related traits of people and seeing how they tend to correlate with binge eating disorder, but also with overweight and obesity status. And it was kind of a review paper that talked through some of those associations, talked through an underlying kind of conceptual theory about how to actually act upon it. And they talked through some recent research that this group has done in terms of trying to intervene and actually influence some of these appetite-related traits. So the whole idea that they present is based on Schachter's externality theory. And the whole idea is that overeating and binge eating are related to high levels of reactivity to external cues to eat, and also reductions in sensitivity to our internal satiety signal. So the idea is that people who are more prone to overeating, whether it's binge eating episodes or just kind of typical overeating in general leading to overweight and obesity, the idea is that there are some of these appetite-related traits inherent to these individuals, which are developed. You know, they're not, you know, intrinsic and unchangeable, but there are these appetite-related traits that seem to correlate with these overeating behaviors, where people tend to be a little bit more responsive to external cues that cause them to eat and eventually overeat. And there's a little bit lower sensitivity to typical intrinsic satiety signals, right? And so the idea is, these cues, by the way, can be really just about anything. These external cues, it could be, you know, every time I walk by a Subway and I smell the bread baking, I'm like, man, I could definitely go for some bread, right? Like that could be a cue.
Ooh, did you see?
I did see.
Was it Ireland?
Yeah.
A court in Ireland ruled that the bread used for Subway subs is not in fact bread.
Yeah, I think it's legally considered a cake or something like that in Ireland. It's a non-bread product for sure.
I think we now have to admit that Food Babe was right all along.
Yeah, let us be the first to do so.
Vanny, if you want to sponsor the podcast, our email is open to you.
Yeah. So, but anyway, there's those external cues, right? Like you're presented with this food that you really like, and that can be a cue, but it can also be the environment that you're in or just habits you've developed, right? So like for me personally, if it's late night and I'm sitting down to like watch something on TV, I typically want to like go make some popcorn. Like I just really like snacking on popcorn. So I've associated the food with the activity, and it might cause me to eat at a time where I have high satiety. Like I'm not actually physiologically hungry. And so the idea is that these traits where we've got these different cues that can cause us to overeat, and a blunted sensitivity to satiety cues that actually tell us like, you're good, you're totally full, it's time to stop eating. The balance of those different factors could have a big role in somebody's propensity to overeat. And so they've done some really cool interventions with this group. So it's kind of one big comprehensive intervention with multiple components to it. But they do stuff like they encourage their participants to monitor their hunger before, during, and after a meal. Like actually take time to think through it and monitor that, and use a 1 to 5 scale before the meal. You know, how is your hunger level or satiety level? Actually give it a rating. And then doing it again during the meal, and then again after the meal, and just kind of reinforcing the idea of getting in tune specifically with satiety cues without being influenced by other things that cause us to eat, such as, you know, one of the obvious ones is just the hedonic sensation of like, I'm eating this because it's really good, and like it stimulates the reward centers of my brain. Like so getting in touch with those satiety cues by actually practicing it. They also do a thing when it comes to food cues, where they would bring in their high craving foods to an actual in-lab visit when they were already like totally satiated, right? So they're full, they're not hungry, they don't have a high desire to eat. And they would bring in their like their biggest trigger foods that cause them to overeat that they tend to crave. And it was honestly just like typical like exposure therapy, right? Just kind of like hanging out with this food, but being in a state where you're like, no, I'm just not going to eat it because I'm not hungry and I don't need to, you know? So doing a little bit of that exposure. They also had them do a 1 to 5 craving scale at home. So they were doing the hunger scales at periodic times, but also the craving scales, and starting to actually think through, am I hungry? Am I having cravings? What might be causing me to have a desire to eat at this particular time? And then of course they gave them education about how neurobiological, physiological, psychological, and environmental factors all can kind of trigger overeating in particularly vulnerable individuals. So it's not just going in and trying to intervene on some of these things, but actually developing an understanding of what are all these different things that can contribute to the desire to eat or the desire to overeat. And so then they would also give them some coping skills as part of the intervention. So they would basically say, when you've got an urge to eat and you're not physiologically hungry, what could we actually do about that? So one thing is just changing the physical state of the body. So they would do like deep breathing exercises or relaxation exercises. They introduced some behavioral alternatives to eating. Just kind of replacing it with other behaviors rather than eating at that time. Changing their attentional focus, so some kind of distraction or imagery, self-motivational statements, a variety of different things to shift their focus and their attention from eating or the desire to eat to something else. And then also they worked on enhancing motivation to resist cues. So actually kind of thinking through cost-benefit analyses and things like that. So one of the reasons I wanted to bring this paper up is because I think it's people in the evidence-based fitness world, when it comes to nutrition, it's usually, we treat people like they're robots, right? And it's like, oh, you've got a nutrition problem, change the calorie number, change the macro composition, maybe change your food selection. But getting into some of the behavioral components, I think a lot of people overlook that and underestimate how big of a barrier some of these things can be. You know, when someone is really, really responsive to external cues to eat, or someone has really lost that ability to tap into their internal satiety cues, that can be such a huge factor, such a huge barrier when it comes to weight loss. And so like for me, I've always found weight loss to be weirdly easy. And I've always wondered why that is, because I'd like to believe I'm just really awesome, but I just don't think that's the case, right? So one of the things that's interesting, and this is really huge for coaches, like if you're a coach and you've been really good at something and you see people struggle with it, you got to think through like what might actually be causing these divergent responses to a given intervention, right? So like if you were born strong and you're just genetically strong and you've always been strong and everything you do works and builds strength, you have to really think hard about your clients that are struggling to put on strength and think, what's the difference here and what are some strategies and solutions? So I think it's really interesting. Like when I read this paper, I was like, yeah, I mean, I have really low responsiveness to external food cues. And that was something that, I mean, maybe it's inherent or innate. Maybe it was developed when I was younger, but it's never been a problem for me. But thinking through it, you can see how for a lot of people, that's a huge barrier to weight loss success. Same thing. I did have an experience where I completely lost touch with my satiety cues. One of the first bodybuilding preps I did after the competition, I was purely eating for hedonic sensations. Like my nutrition had nothing to do with obtaining nutrients at that point. And it was crazy because when you're in that like really, when you've got that serious post-competition hyperphagia, you're like eating past satiety to an extent you just couldn't even believe. Like I've never been that full and thought, I'm going in for more, like, you know, somebody hold me back. So it's just really interesting to think through some of these things and think about nutrition outside of the macros, outside of these little food swaps, and get into the behaviors, get into the things that can predispose someone to overeat. And if you're a coach, knowing about this stuff is really critical. And the thing I really like about it is that there are some actionable things you can do to actually influence some of these things. So, if you've got a client or if you yourself are really responsive to external eating cues, there are things you can do to actually be proactive and try to address that head on, which I think is really cool. So it was a really nice paper. And for someone who, like, I would never claim to have any expertise on the behavioral side of things when it comes to nutrition, but even for someone like me, you could dive into the paper and really get some good stuff out of it.
Yeah, so my next is effects of horizontal and incline bench press on neuromuscular adaptations in untrained young men by Chavez and colleagues. And so I wanted to talk about this paper for a couple of reasons. One is that, so there have been like a fair amount of EMG studies on various pressing variations. So, flat bench, close grip bench, wide grip, incline, decline, etc., whatever. And then people trying to draw inferences about hypertrophy from EMG differences, which is, somewhat suspect. It's not quite like reading tarot cards, but it's not...
It's a very tenuous leap to make.
Yeah. And so this was the first study comparing longitudinal adaptations between flat bench and inclined bench. And so, I think like most people would read this and be like, okay, hypertrophy is really the only outcome that matters here. Do you need incline to build your upper chest? And is it that much better? And will it maybe neglect your lower chest? Like, do you need to do both? But they looked at both hypertrophy and strength. So the hypertrophy measures they took were pec thicknesses at three different points. So in the second, third, and fifth intercostal spaces, which you can just think of as like upper, mid, and lower chest. And also they looked at strength. They did isometric flat bench and incline bench as their strength assessments, which... I wasn't crazy about, but it is what it is. And so they had people trained for 8 weeks, just pressing once a week, and they had three groups. One of them was doing only flat bench, one of them was doing only incline press, and the other one was doing 50-50 flat and incline bench for 4 to 6 total sets of pressing per week, sets of 8 to 12 to failure. So, pretty basic, straightforward hypertrophy training. And in terms of what they found is that all three groups had similar strength outcomes assessed via changes in isometric, incline, and flat bench. I didn't find that too surprising. Someone could look at that and be like, oh, so exercise specificity is a lie. It didn't pan out in this study. I don't necessarily think that's the case because they weren't doing isometric bench press for their training. So I think that an isometric test is more just testing kind of like generalized pressing strength instead of the actual motor patterns that were being changed. But anyway, all three interventions had similar impacts on isometric pressing strength. In terms of growth, which is what people probably mostly care about, is that middle and lower pec growth were similar in all three groups, but there was more upper pec growth in the group doing exclusively incline bench. So you could read that, and I think quite a few people have read that because I've seen quite a few people sharing and discussing this study. You could look at that and say like, hey, look, the bodybuilders were right all along. If you want to develop your upper chest, you need to do some incline pressing. Maybe that's with a barbell, maybe it's with dumbbells, but you really, really need the incline work to build your upper chest. And I think that's probably true, but... there was a really weird thing about this study that I haven't seen anyone discussing, and that's that just like the hypertrophy outcomes were fucking bonkers. So there were 9 different hypertrophy outcomes. So upper, middle, and lower pec growth in 3 different groups. And the smallest amount of hypertrophy in any group for any region... for any region of the pecs was a 24% increase in thickness. The largest was a 62% increase in thickness, which was basically going from like 15 millimeters to 25 millimeters, give or take, which is crazy. And the average across all groups and all sites was 44%. So averaging across all groups and all sites, that's a rate of increase in pec thickness of about 5% per week. And for that one that was a 62% increase, that's like 6.25% per week. And so you might hear that and say like, oh, well, it might just be acute edema. Like, did they take the ultrasound scans, 20 minutes after the last training session or like a day after the last training session? No, it says in the methods they took those ultrasound scans a week after the final training session, which should be plenty of time for edema to dissipate. And just to contextualize like how extreme a 5 or like 6.25% increase per week is for changes in pec thickness, there's a review paper from 2007 by Wernbaum that everyone cites that just like takes all of the hypertrophy literature up to 2007 and just looks at, like, you know, how does intensity affect hypertrophy? How does volume and reps per week affect hypertrophy? How does total length of training time affect rates of hypertrophy? And there was, like, one study that was cited in the Wernbaum review that found a rate of hypertrophy of like 5% per week. But that was in a study that I think lasted either 1 week or 2 weeks. So, you know, that's not hypertrophy. That is edema. And the next highest was, I think, like 3% per week. So we're seeing rates of hypertrophy up to twofold faster than have ever been reported previously. So anyway, you could read this paper and say, hey, you got to do incline pressing to build your upper chest. Or you could read this paper and say, hey, how the fuck did people grow that much? Period. And the choice, dear listener, is up to you.
I really like season three. Greg is a changed man. You've already said, you know what? The food babe was right. And now you're saying, you know what? The bodybuilders were right. And this is a very humble version of Greg in season three. I really like this.
Oh, man.
All right. Let's talk creatine. Everybody likes creatine. So, new paper out, creatine supplementation does not influence the ratio between intracellular water and skeletal muscle mass in resistance-trained men. So the whole idea, this is something that I've been really thinking about lately. Why? I don't know. It just keeps me up at night. But for the longest time when it comes to creatine, the biggest question that bodybuilders always ask is, do I need to cut it before a competition? Or, you know, fitness models, do I need to cut it before a photo shoot? The idea being, you know, creatine could potentially cause some fluid retention and they don't want to look watery and puffy and bloated and lose definition due to water retention. And so I think probably the most common answer to that is don't worry about it. Creatine is stored within the cell and it draws water into the cell because it's osmolytic. And so if anything, you know, the cell is going to, you know, puff up and it's going to draw water from the extracellular space and you're going to look huge and shredded and good to go. But for some reason, I was like, what's the evidence for that? And several weeks ago, I started looking into it. And while that sounds good theoretically, that just doesn't seem to be what happens in studies that look at intracellular and extracellular water in response to creatine. So this study, I did deduct 2 study points out of 100. I have a running tally. The way they calculated effect size got under my skin a little bit, but anyone who reads Mass knows that Greg and I just complain about that all the time, so I'm not going to dwell on it. But anyway, that's really not critical to understanding the study. What they found was it was a nice study. They did this really long lead-in kind of training program. I think it was like 16 weeks of training leading into it to get everybody kind of on the same footing. Mm-hmm. And then an actual 8-week training intervention with the creatine being provided. And what they found, you know, one group got creatine, one group got placebo. They all did 8 weeks of resistance training. Intracellular water increased more in the creatine group than the placebo group. And that was a statistically significant difference. But the extracellular water changes did not differ between groups. And so you might look at that on the surface and say, oh, intracellular water, there was a difference. Extracellular water, there was not. And so clearly that's what we're seeing, right? Water drawn out of the extracellular compartment into the intracellular and we're good to go. But those results don't actually mean that extracellular water didn't increase at all in response to creatine supplementation. And they don't necessarily even indicate that there was a disproportionate shift of fluid from the extracellular to the intracellular space. And so in this study, the increases in skeletal muscle mass, intracellular water, and total body water were higher in the creatine group than the placebo, but the ratio of intracellular water to skeletal muscle mass, that ratio did not change due to creatine supplementation. And so if you look at just basically the simple ratio, what percentage of their total body water was intracellular or extracellular, that particular ratio stayed pretty constant. And so those changes in intracellular water were largely due or largely attributable to an increase in skeletal muscle mass that occurred over the duration of the intervention. And so when you look at other studies that have done similar things, where we give one group creatine, the other group a placebo, and look at changes in extracellular water, intracellular water, total body water, what we do find is that creatine tends to increase total body water a little bit, both in short-term and in long-term interventions. And what we find is that the actual ratio of, you know, intracellular water to extracellular water doesn't really change much. It stays pretty stable. So it looks like creatine can increase total body water, but it doesn't look like there's some huge shift from the extracellular to the intracellular fluid compartment. So I just think a lot of people are kind of saying that because it feels good and because it seems right. But I don't think the evidence actually supports that idea that your cells, you know, your cells are just going to be like sponges and your muscles are sucking up this fluid from the extracellular compartment. And when you think about it, so if we want to say like, how much does creatine go up? So there are non-responders and there are people that have really high responses to creatine supplementation. But generally speaking, you could say it'll go up about 20%, right? Your muscle creatine saturation after supplementation. So if your muscle creatine saturation goes up 20% from supplementation, the overall osmolarity of your muscle cells only going to increase by 2 or 3%.
And so, because to be clear, there are a lot of things in your muscles other than creatine.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we think, oh God, 20% higher creatine, that's going to be 20% higher osmolarity. There's going to be this huge shift in fluid. It's really a much more subtle shift. And, you know, there is something called regulatory volume decrease where the cell can kind of balance things out, you know, even in response to a pretty big osmotic stress. And so things do seem to kind of balance out in terms of that intracellular and extracellular fluid storage. So I don't think it's fair to say that the water weight that might be attributable to creatine is purely due to intracellular fluid. However, I still think that the take home, like the actual practical implications are probably similar. Like, I don't think that just because there's a small increase in extracellular water, that means a bodybuilder should be cutting creatine before a competition, or that a fitness model should be cutting their creatine before a photo shoot. Because you have to keep in mind, extracellular water is not the same thing as subcutaneous water. I think a lot of people have that in their mind, mm-hmm. that if there's an increase in extracellular water, for some reason, it's just going to go straight under the skin and wash out all your definition, and it's going to be bad news. That's not the case. There's a lot of different places for extracellular water to go, and really only that subcutaneous fluid storage is going to really make a big difference in terms of how you look on stage or in your photo shoot. So,
and everyone knows for that, all you need to do is switch to a tilapia only diet because that thins the skin.
Exactly. Well, and some rice cakes, tilapia and a rice cake.
Correct.
Yeah. So, but yeah, so the idea is you can still keep your creatine in if you're a bodybuilder getting ready for a photo shoot, whatever the case may be. But I think we probably ought to be a little bit more cautious about definitively stating if you take creatine, you're going to have this big increase in intracellular water and no increase at all in extracellular water. That doesn't seem to be supported by any of the studies that have actually looked at that directly.
Where do you think that came from? Do you think it was like partially reactive? Because I remember maybe like a decade ago, a bunch of people saying like, hey, if you take creatine, you're going to get super bloated. Do you think that there was almost, you know, just kind of like a pendulum swing where people were like, no, it's actually fine to take creatine? And in fact, it's good actually, because it's going to make you look leaner.
Yeah, I think it probably was reactionary. And I think it's one of those, the logic is intuitive enough that you wouldn't think too hard about it. Mm-hmm. You know, like there are some claims where you would say, well, I got to see some evidence for this. But with creatine and intracellular water storage, I think it's such an intuitive thing that you could say, oh yeah, that totally makes sense. Not think too hard about fluid balance and fluid distribution and say, yeah, it's just going to go in the cell. Extracellular is not going to change at all because why would it? And I think it was just so intuitive that it kind of would preclude you from actually digging in and saying, well, somebody's got to show me this. And so if you look at the studies where you actually try to really assess that, you might find one study, and this is another thing that I think contributes to it. If you look at a study, it's not uncommon with these studies to see that the increase in intracellular water is statistically significant and the increase in extracellular is not. But when you actually calculate the ratios, it's pretty much unchanged.
And that's just because there's more intracellular than extracellular water, period, right?
Yeah, there is. So intracellular, is typically going to be 60-66% of your total body water. It is a slightly larger fluid compartment than extracellular water. So that plays into it for sure in terms of finding that statistical significance. You've got a little bit more fluctuation going on. So in fitness, we have these things that just become cliche, right? Like you just repeat it over and over. And I know I've probably said that dozens of times in the past because like everybody says it, right? Nah, it's just intracellular. Don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. And there's a little bit more nuance to it than that. But the take home point is still the same. I don't think people should be cutting their creatine before bodybuilding shows or photo shoots because, extracellular water probably will increase a little bit, but it's probably not going to unfavorably affect the physique.
That checks out. All right. My next study, and I believe my last study for this research roundup, is titled Mu Opioid Receptor Induced Synaptic Plasticity in Dopamine Neurons Mediates the Rewarding Properties of Anabolic Androgenic Steroids by Bontempi and Bonchi. So that was a mouthful, and I'm not going to get into the details of this study too much. Firstly, because I think I understand it pretty well, but this is comfortably outside my like core area of expertise. So if I tried to explain it, I'd probably get several details wrong. And also because like, I don't know, I feel like this is one of the, so this is a mouse study. And so I think that the concept matters more than the specific experimental model and findings. But anyway, so one of the things I've seen bandied about on the forums and argued over for a long, long time is whether or not steroids are addictive in kind of the classical sense. And some people who generally tend to be like pretty radically anti-steroid just treat steroid addiction as if it's like a thing that, basically functions the same way as like nicotine addiction or like, the worst of them, marijuana addiction. There will be some people saying that. And then a lot of people who I suspect either use steroids or at least like have buddies who use steroids will say like, no, they're not actually addictive, but like they may kind of appear to be addictive because people go on them, they get crazy gains and like they don't want to lose their gains. And so like, yeah, of course they're going to keep taking them, but it's more because they like the outcome less than like, actual like chemical processes in the brain induced by the steroids. And so this was a paper in mice basically looking to see if like neural shit that looks like neural shit that happens when people take classically addictive substances also occur when you give mice steroids. And so basically they did. So there was, what's it called? Like when you get a runner's high, like what are those things?
Endorphins?
Called? Yeah. So when they gave these rats steroids, there was a pretty large increase in endorphins and impacts on the mu opioid receptor that caused some synaptic changes that looked relatively comparable to changes that would be induced with actual opioid injection. And so basically the authors of the study argue that for some people, and I guess just mammals in general, steroids might actually be kind of classically addictive. And the findings of this study do actually comport relatively well with some observational human research. So there's some human research showing that people who are habitual users of steroids when prescribed opioid pain medication are more likely to become addicted to or dependent on opioids than people who are prescribed those same medications who aren't also habitual steroid users. So it seems like there's some degree of overlap in the kind of addiction causing or influencing neural pathways between opioids and steroids, and that people who might be at an elevated risk of opioid addiction or dependence might also be at a somewhat elevated risk of steroid addiction or dependence. And so to be clear, I'm not saying, not even coming anywhere close to saying that everyone who uses steroids are addicted to steroids, nor am I saying that addiction is even likely. So one of the things to note is like the qualitative neural impacts seem to be similar between steroids and opioids, but the magnitude of those impacts way, way bigger with opioids. So like, don't clip this and say like, hey, Greg is saying that steroids are just as addictive as fucking Vicodin, because I'm not.
Or even cheese.
Or even cheese, and certainly not marijuana. But I think this is just something to generally be aware of. So one of the things we've talked about on this podcast multiple times is like, we don't give a shit if people use steroids, but you know, before you do anything, like before you make any sort of momentous decision, you should be fully aware of the risks. And if like actual kind of chemical dependency is a risk, I don't think that's a risk that a lot of people are aware of. Like, it's not a risk that I was aware of. And to be clear, it's not like fully established, but there seems to be growing evidence that that is a potential risk here. So yeah, like I would say if either you have dealt with opioid dependency issues or you have like a family history of opioid dependency issues, maybe be more cautious before deciding to use steroids, or, you know, just something to be aware of to put into your calculus when it comes to making that decision.
I think that's one of the least satisfying things about getting into reading research, is that like for a paper like this, like your conclusions were basically like, here's a thing that I'm not fully sure what to do with, but it is a thing that exists. Store that somewhere in your brain. Mm-hmm. You know, like developing that patience when you're reading research and saying like, here's one paper finding a thing that may or may not be relevant. I'll wait 6 or 7 years and see if I'm still concerned about it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you really have to develop that patience, especially when it's a novel idea and you're like, well, we need to wait to see if this kind of snowballs into a line of research to see if more findings seem to kind of converge with this finding and show a similar thing. I remember when I first got into like, when I first found out people were doing research about stuff I cared about, and I was like, oh, so I can actually go find it myself, thinking that I would find like open a paper and that paper would have my answer. Mm-hmm. You know, and this is one of those lines of research where it's just not even close.
Yeah. And I mean, also like it's one of those things where like it wouldn't necessarily be impossible to do research like this in humans. Not the exact study they did on the mice, because to actually look at some of the physical neuronal changes, they basically like administered steroids to these mice, looked to see how it changed their behavior, and then like decapitated them. And, you know, so they could actually look at their brains.
Yeah.
So you can't do that on humans. But, you know, there are models that people can use to do research on addiction. The problem is like, much like the marijuana research that Eric discussed earlier, it's one of those things where it's hard, like you can't really do RCTs because you got to get them by an IRB. And, you know, now weed is like legal in some places, but like recreational steroid use isn't legal anywhere in the US. Like theoretically this could be done in another country, but at least in the US, like you can't go to an IRB and say like, hey, we're going to inject people with either like a shitload of Tren or a placebo and see how that affects like addictive behavior. So it's one of those things where it's almost like, so it's not as strong. I'm certainly not claiming it's as strong as like the tobacco research. But like one of the whole things with tobacco research and its links to cancer was there were like multiple experimental models showing that like, you know, here's the impact of tobacco smoke on like some cell line, like in vitro research. Here's some epidemiological research. Here's experimental research, but in animals. And you put all of that together and you start developing a very, very clear idea that smoking cigarettes probably either causes or dramatically elevates your risk of lung cancer. But then people could say, like, look, I mean, you haven't done RCTs on humans where, like, you force one group of people to smoke 4 packs a day for 30 years and, like, give other people, I guess, placebo cigarettes. I don't know. So, you know, until we have that top quality evidence to prove it, who's really to say? And I feel like that's how, you know, a lot of research on marijuana is, a lot of research on steroids is, like, you know, there are multiple lines of evidence that you can look at to kind of develop a probabilistic idea of what some of these effects are. But like the number of RCTs in humans is really low because mostly they were done before these substances became illegal. And now that they are illegal, at least most places, like, it's hard to get something by the IRB.
Definitely. All right. So the research roundup segment is almost over. I'm just going to take a very quick look at a couple extra studies here. So the first one, I'm not going to go into detail because I'm actually going to be writing a mass article about it this upcoming month. But I just wanted to give a little piece to get people excited about this, you know, to whet the appetite a bit. So this article, the reason I want to address it, because I've gotten some questions about it, because the title is quite controversial. So the title is, Metabolic Adaptation is an Illusion, Only Present When Participants Are in Negative Energy Balance. And so, like, you know, I've written about metabolic adaptation.
That's a good clickbait title.
Yeah. And so, like, people see that title and they're like, ooh, Eric, shots fired. Any thoughts? So a couple things that I just want to briefly mention. So they said gold standard methods were used for the measurement of RMR and body composition. And for body composition, they used BODPOD. The whole study is invalid now. If you're calling BODPOD a gold standard body composition method, I'm throwing out the baby with the bathwater. The whole thing's invalidated. I'm being partially facetious, but gold standard has to mean something. You know, like, it either means something or it doesn't. No one in their right mind is calling BODPOD a gold standard method for body composition. That's insane. Like, it's a mostly suitable, reasonably justifiable. Dude, I'll be honest. Sometimes if you submit a paper where your only body comp method was BODPOD, you're nervous that the reviewers are going to accept it to just say, like, yeah, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that you're calling that gold standard is insane. Anyway, getting to the real stuff. So they said that metabolic adaptation is an illusion, but if you look at their results, they did find that at the time points they're looking at, the individuals, their measured resting metabolic rate was lower than their predicted resting metabolic rate. And you might be thinking, well, maybe, you know, maybe it wasn't statistically significant. So they're saying that's why it didn't exist. Like, there was no adaptation because even though it was lower than predicted, it wasn't significant or something like that. But it was. So, like, they identified that resting metabolic rate was lower than predicted. And that difference between measured and predicted was statistically significant. So
how long was the actual, like, hypocaloric intervention? Like, was that week 1 to week 9, or was that week 1 to week 13?
No, so the whole idea was that from week 9 to week 13, that would be the period where they were at energy balance.
Okay.
So that
okay.
they would do the hypocaloric thing, see it present, and then after they put them in energy balance, like, okay, it's totally gone.
Gotcha.
But, like, it was still present, and it wasn't huge, but, like, it was there. It was statistically significant. The idea that you would take that finding, like, if you want to say like, wow, this is too small to care about, and, you know, we challenge that this is a major barrier to weight loss or weight maintenance success, yeah, throw that in the title. But the idea that you're just like total illusion, a figment of your imagination, it's like, but you found it.
Yeah. So do you think this comes down, like, when people say metabolic adaptation, I think there's a question of like definitions, right? So, you know, are you defining metabolic adaptation as, hey, when you go into an energy deficit, your resting metabolic rate decreases, and like that's one of the things that might make you have to drop to a lower calorie intake than you thought you would to continue losing weight? Or are you defining metabolic adaptation as like when you achieve a steady new lower body weight, your RMR is still decreased? Like, when I hear people talk about metabolic adaptation, it seems to be more similar to that first definition that, like, hey, when you go into a deficit or surplus, your metabolic rate adapts to it. And, you know, that might affect how many calories you have to eat to gain or lose weight. When people talk about metabolic adaptation in the literature, is this what they're talking about? That like lingering effects on RMR once people get back to energy balance?
I mean, people look at it from very different angles. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's a universal way to look at it in the literature. I can tell you the way that I tend to look at it. I mean, I think that being in a deficit is part of the equation when it comes to active weight loss. Mm-hmm. So I am interested in seeing, when you're actively losing weight, how much lower are we seeing things drop? But another thing to keep in mind is that I find resting metabolic rate to be one of the least interesting facets of metabolic adaptation. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at the literature as a whole, the changes in resting metabolic rate aren't really that notable, and they become even less notable at energy balance. And so I find a lot of papers take that singular focus looking at resting metabolic rate, and I understand why methodologically it makes sense to do that, because like the other components of resting of total energy expenditure are quite difficult to measure.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when someone says like, oh, that whole concept of metabolic adaptation, throw it out because of something about resting metabolic rate at energy balance, I just think that the concept of understanding and planning for metabolic adaptation is so much more useful than just looking at resting metabolic rate in an energy balance state. You know, so I think there's still a tremendous amount of value, even if we can't really act upon it too much, of at least understanding what to expect when we talk about, over the course of a diet, what are we going to have to do to our caloric intake? And part of that is this adaptive process that's present in an energy balanced state. But practically speaking, we have to account for the fact that when you're in a deficit, it's augmented, it's exaggerated. And that's affecting our ability to push the diet forward to some extent. And then when you factor in a lot of the endocrine changes that accompany it, when you factor in some of the side effects associated with that, the fatigue, the lethargic feelings, the reproductive side effects. I mean, when we talk about the series of adaptations that accompany a pretty serious weight loss attempt, it goes well beyond resting metabolic rate. To be sure. So a lot of people saw that title and were like, damn, Eric, you got dunked on by science. And like, first of all, even with their very particular approach to defining metabolic adaptation, they still found it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the utility of metabolic adaptation and at least understanding it goes far beyond the scope of that definition. Okay. So moving on, there was a couple things I wanted to mention. So this paper, it was called "Are Questionable Research Practices Facilitating New Discoveries in Sport and Exercise Medicine? The Proportion of Supported Hypotheses is Implausibly High."
Shocked, I tell you.
So
shocked.
Exercise science, you're on notice officially. It was really cool. I like this paper. They just kind of took a little survey of of the studies in sport and exercise medicine, as they called it, looked at kind of a cross section of some of the higher tier journals, for whatever those tiers are worth. So in their sample that they looked at, they had 215 original research studies. Only 60% of them reported a hypothesis of any kind,
which is fucking crazy.
That's a low number.
When I learned about science in what, like fucking seventh grade?
Yeah.
Step one is like generate a hypothesis, and step two is like, you know, design an experiment, then carry it out, then collect your data, see if it supports or refutes your hypothesis, and then go back to the drawing board. Like, dude, all the shit we do, except for like systematic reviews, whatever, like you don't need a hypothesis for that. Or if you're just like reporting normative data,
right,
whatever. But like most of the experimental research in our field should have a fucking hypothesis. Like, yeah.
Well, they're doing hypothesis tests.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is crazy. Yeah. Like, anything where you're reporting a p-value, that's like reporting compatibility with a null hypothesis. But like, if you don't have a fucking alternate hypothesis, what's your goddamn null? How do you define what it is? That's so crazy. That's insane.
Yeah. You'd want it to be higher than 60%. Is my response. So of those 60% that reported at least one hypothesis, these researchers kind of identified the primary, you know, main hypothesis. So of those studies, 82%, reported that their hypothesis was supported by their study's results. So if you reported a hypothesis in your paper, 82% of the time you were saying, yep, and we found exactly what we thought. So of those that were supported, so of the studies whose primary hypothesis was supported by their results based on their interpretation, 71% reported that the primary hypothesis was fully supported by the results. And then the rest said, like, ah, oh, it's partial support of our hypothesis, or it was just unclear if it was full or partial support. So the idea was not many researchers out there are reporting hypotheses at all. And those that do typically have a very high success rate of finding data that support their hypothesis. And there's a number of reasons why that might be, but that the general purpose of this paper was to call on people in our field, like, hey, report more hypotheses, and sometimes you should be wrong.
Yeah.
Sometimes. You found something interesting. I remember you were kind of looking into something not quite this, but similar to this, and you had found that in a lot of the exercise science studies, there were like a ton of hypotheses that were just, the success rate was absurdly high because the hypotheses were just like
the safest thing.
Yeah, just completely obvious, right? Like if we do an 8-week aerobic exercise intervention in untrained people, VO2 peak will go up.
Yeah.
Yeah, like it was just slam dunks.
Yeah, so there's a lot of that. Yeah, I don't know. I have some thoughts. It's probably not worth going down this rabbit hole because we would be here for like 45 minutes.
Yeah. Maybe for another show.
Yeah. The other thing I'd say is like not only do people need to report their hypotheses, but like there really, really needs to be a more robust system and a more robust set of expectations that like not only will you report your hypotheses in the study, but that like you will either pre-register hypotheses beforehand or publish registered reports where like you have to state your hypotheses beforehand. Man, I don't have the paper pulled up in front of me, but I feel like I can describe it reasonably well. So I think we've talked about registered reports on the podcast before, but just like a very, very brief primer on them again for people who missed that episode. In the traditional publishing model, basically you get a study approved, you collect the data, you analyze it, you write it up, then you submit it for publication and it either gets accepted or rejected. With registered reports, you develop an idea for a study, and generally first step would still be getting it approved by ethics at your school. And then once that's done, you just basically submit the methods and the data analysis plan to a journal. And the journal either accepts it and says like, hey, you know, based on what you say you're going to do and how you're going to analyze your data, we think that whatever the results are, it will be valuable to our readers. Or they reject it. They say, like, your methods are shit. The way you want to analyze this data is stupid. We don't want this. And so with a registered report, once you get it accepted before you do it, like before you actually carry out the study. And then once you carry out the study, you analyze the data the way you said you were going to, and then you publish it. And after the paper's been accepted on the front end, where you just submitted your methods and data analysis plan, whatever your results are, the journal will publish it, as long as you actually did the study the way you said you were going to and analyzed the data the way you said you were going to. So anyway, with that background, the thing with registered reports is, like, it removes the incentive to do dodgy stuff with data, either just to sit on it if you don't get the results you wanted, or to, you know, hark or p-hack or, you know, change your hypotheses after the fact in order to get a significant result that might be more publishable. So, like, it basically removes those incentives because the paper has already been accepted just on the strength of the methods. And so in psychology, they are starting to publish more registered reports. And so there's been at least a couple studies that compare the rates of statistically significant positive results in the direction of the author's hypotheses in traditional papers versus registered reports. And in traditional papers, it's like 80-85%. In registered reports, it's like 50-60%, which checks out. Like, you know, if people know their field, like, they're going to generate hypotheses that pan out more often than not. But there's, like, a way, way lower success rate in registered reports than traditional articles. So, like, do with that information what you will.
Yeah. Yeah. And so for more information on this kind of stuff, our most recent fireside chat, we talked all about the particulars of, like, open science and registered reports and all that stuff. So listeners can go.
Wasn't it two fireside chats ago?
It was one of the fireside chats.
One of the fairly recent ones.
Yeah, it's out there. Another paper along these same lines, it was called Call to Increase Statistical Collaboration in Sports Science, Sport and Exercise Medicine, and Sports Physiotherapy. So it was basically a paper saying, hey, everybody, let's do some good stats. It was just a positive thing. You know, hey, let's start doing better with this stuff, which is good. You know, but what they were basically calling for, I think their biggest request in this paper is basically, listen, you're an exercise scientist, and let's be clear, exercise scientists, like, you have to be an expert in the theory of the topic you study. You have to be an expert in the methods, which are not easy to do. I mean, there's a lot of methods that are highly technical. You have to, like, build apparatuses to, like, actually make it work, right? So if you go to, like, a neuromuscular focused laboratory, they've got all sorts of contraptions where they had to bring in an engineer and a carpenter, and they've got to be, like, you know, they need someone who's, like, an electrical engineer to do all the, you know, all the stuff they're trying to do. So it's advanced theory, it's advanced, very technical methods. And then on top of that, in your free time, you're supposed to learn how to be a statistician at a high level. So, like, we're asking a lot of exercise scientists without collaboration. And so this paper is saying, like, what if you just did collaborate? You know, so, like, reach out to people in these fields that are more quantitative in focus. Team up with a biostatistician, a statistician, a data scientist, an epidemiologist, a mathematician, all these different fields that do some of this very quantitative work and might be able to make your statistical analysis even better without you needing to somehow find enough free time to basically get a PhD in biostats, right? Because that ain't going to happen with all the stuff you're currently doing. And I will say this. So in my short publishing career, I have had the privilege of collaborating with a biostatistician, an epidemiologist, and a mathematician across different projects. And those have been awesome projects. I'm telling you, if you're a sports scientist listening to this, or if you're a student who wants to get into research, if you can find ways to collaborate with those people, it's a really fantastic idea. The coolest projects I've done, analyses where I didn't have to, you know, completely lead the way and was able to learn from the more skilled people doing it. Really, really good stuff.
Okay, so Greg, I don't think we're going to have time for a Q&A segment. I think we might want to do our coach's corner and call it a day. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, that works.
Cool. So Q&A, we'll do them all next episode. We're going to be putting them up every 2 weeks, folks. We are back. So let me scroll ahead here to the coach's corner. Yeah, so this is a question that quite a few people have messaged me about. So on my personal Instagram page, at Trexler Fitness, some of the hottest content on Instagram, and a lot of people are saying maybe too hot for Instagram, but for now, I'm posting. So on my personal page, I started doing something called recommended reads, where I basically say like, hey, here's a cool exercise science article or paper or whatever, go check that out. And so what I shared was, there is a review paper by Mike Israetel and colleagues called Mesocycle Progression in Hypertrophy, Volume versus Intensity. And so basically the whole idea of their paper was that their assessment of the literature would suggest that kind of the ideal way to make progression occur throughout the course of a mesocycle from week to week is by adding additional sets into the program. Now, Brian Miner and colleagues, including the good doctor Eric Helms, they published a letter to the editor, kind of a response to this paper. And they argued against a number of points in the paper and suggested a slightly different way of progressing things throughout the course of a mesocycle. And so I shared this this back and forth, and a lot of people asked, you know, Eric, what's your approach to progressing things along over the course of a mesocycle? And also, and probably more importantly, what's Greg's approach? Because Greg is the training guy. So Greg, over the course of a mesocycle, week to week, we're going to be adjusting some training variables, you know, to kind of nudge things along, I assume. So, I mean, do you have any strong feelings one way or the other? Because this turned into, they kind of did like a round table on the Revive Stronger podcast with Steve Hall. And, you know, there's a lot of back and forth. Do you have any, what camp are you in, if any?
I'm probably closer to the Helms camp, honestly. So let me start by arguing against that and why I think there might be some value in progressing sets on like shorter timescales. One is that, the first reason that I think there might be value in progressing sets over the course of a mesocycle is there's not, say, like RCTs showing that that's the best way to approach it, but there are a few studies where, like, basically what they do is they take people, ask them what their training has looked like for like the 2, 3, 4 weeks leading up to the study, get a baseline of how many sets that they were previously doing, and then increase their set volume by like 20%. And like there will be different like research questions layered on top of that, but like that's the way they go about dictating volume in those studies. And one of the things I've noticed about those studies is they tend to have relatively low non-response rates compared to the broader literature. So especially if you're doing research on trained individuals, it's not incredibly uncommon for, say, between like a quarter and a fifth of your subjects to not gain muscle over the course of the study, which makes sense. I don't like the term non-responder because they're probably not non-responders in a general sense, but like, hey, you know, the training intervention that you're using in the study may either be excessive for some folks or not enough for some folks. And so you wind up with non-trivial rates of non-response where people fail to get bigger. In the studies I've seen where the way they dictate volume is a 20% increase from an individual's baseline, they tend to have pretty low rates of non-response, which suggests that volume increases in terms of the number of sets people are doing is a pretty reliable way, not necessarily to maximize hypertrophy strictly, but to just ensure that some hypertrophy will occur like over the next 8 weeks or 12 weeks or something like that. And the thing I'll note about that is that's, I don't know a ton about how Mike programs training, Mike Isertel, but I think that's different from the way he does it, because that's essentially like, we're going to bump your volume up 20% and you're going to stay at this 20% elevated level for the next 2 or 3 months, versus like, you know, we're going to bump you up 20%. In another 4 weeks, we're going to bump you up another 10%. In another 4 weeks, we're going to bump you up another 10%. But anyway, to some degree, it seems like volume increases help with like the reliability of like muscle hypertrophy occurring.
Yeah. In this, in the paper itself, they have like a diagram where they add 2 sets every week.
Oh yeah. That's not what they're doing in those studies that I'm describing.
Yeah. So over 6 weeks in this figure, it goes from 10 up to 20 sets, and then week 7 drops down to 5.
Yeah, yeah. So that's not what they're doing in the studies I'm talking about. That's like a 20% increase and just staying at 20%.
Right.
The other thing I would say is that of the targets that you can kind of aim at for like prescribing training variables and keeping people engaged, I think that adding sets is a pretty decent tool in the arsenal, because and I think that's especially true for exercises you can't load quite as heavily. So, you know, let's say you have someone who's doing dumbbell press and their current working weight is 40 pounds per hand. And the next jump they're going to take is to 45, which is in excess of a 10% jump in load. So, you know, they need to get quite a bit stronger before they can still do a fair number of reps with that load increase. But also, like, you know, if you change from, say, having them aim for sets of 8 to sets of 10, you know, you can probably do sets of 8 at like 80% of 1RM, and you can probably do sets of 10 at like 75% of 1RM. And so, you know, to go from, say, prescribing 3 sets of 8 to 3 sets of 10, they might have to get 5% stronger. So that's still like a relatively big jump. Whereas it seems like, especially when sets aren't taken to failure, folks seem to get maybe like 3-ish% weaker on average set to set. And so, you know, if someone can knock out, say, 3 sets of 8, and you want to eventually progress them towards being able to do 3 sets of 10 and maybe 3 sets of 12 before you bump them up to the 45-pound dumbbells, what you could do, and what I tend to do, is get to the point that they can do 3 sets of 8. And then before we try to jump to sets of 10, we go to 4 sets of 8, because they'll be able to complete the 4th set of 8 before they'll be able to complete the 3rd set of 10. So it's not so much about increasing volume per se. It's more about folks who like quantitative goals in terms of like, here's the weight I'm working with, and I want a set in rep goal to work towards, and then just what's reasonable. So what I tend to do is like 3 sets of 8, 4 sets of 8, 5 sets of 8, then jump to sets of 10, 3 sets of 10, 4 sets of 10, 5 sets of 10, then jump to sets of 12, 3 sets of 12, 4 sets of 12, 5 sets of 12, and then increase load. And generally, again, for exercises where you're dealing with large relative load increases. So, you know, if someone has to jump from like 30 to 35 pound dumbbells for a particular exercise. And again, that's not so much about trying to increase volume to maximize hypertrophy. It's more just about giving people reasonable quantitative goals to shoot for, to keep them excited and engaged, and allowing them to make like quantitative progress that keeps them invested. Those are some reasons why I might would argue in favor of set increases across like somewhat shorter timescales. But I think that in general, if you think about training conceptually, and you assume that like for an individual, there's a given level of volume that is the best for them. Like, we don't know what that is. That's a needle in the haystack that you're looking for. But like, theoretically, there's probably going to be some level of volume that's ideal for that individual. And then my opinion, this could be right, this could be wrong, this is how I feel, is that there's kind of a plateau where along that plateau, you're basically doing more work but not getting much extra in return. So I don't think that you hit a pinnacle on kind of the volume hypertrophy relationship and then immediately start dropping off. So, you know, let's say that for a given lift, like four sets per exercise is ideal for you. I don't think five sets is going to be worse than four. I think it's going to be pretty similar. And maybe up to like eight sets will get you similar growth, and then it's going to start dropping off from there. So I think that like you can wind up in a situation where you're doing more and more work and not really getting much extra in return for it. And one thing I'll note is that like that's not just my feeling. Like I think the general volume dose response research kind of supports that, where really, really low volumes tend to not cause much hypertrophy. And then in studies that have like three levels of volume, generally like moderate and high have relatively similar results as far as hypertrophy goes. So I think that like past a certain point, you're just kind of progressing through that dead zone where you're doing more work and not really getting much extra in return for it. And then like, you know, there's also the question of risk and, just like risk and ROI. Like if you can theoretically do like a third less volume than you're currently doing and still get the same basic results, like one, it's just inefficient to do more. And then two, like, injuries inevitably happen. Like that's just something that occurs with training. And if you, so we don't know like 100% all of the risk factors for injuries and resistance training, but just like exposure seems to be a big one that like people who do more total training, whether that's putting in more hours per week, putting in more sets per workout, like however you want to quantify it, people who have a greater number of exposures seem to get injured more often kind of per unit of calendar time. So like if it's basically like, what's my risk of getting injured in the next year? The more you train, the greater your risk is, kind of all else being equal. And so, I mean, like, I think to some degree, you're just increasing your exposure and risk. And like I said previously, probably not getting too much in return for it. So I think that your better bet is just to try to find a level of volume that works, that allows you to accomplish what you want to accomplish. It is helping you get stronger. It is helping you get bigger. And just stick with that until it isn't working anymore. And then, you know, and then you may need to increase volume from there, or you may need to decrease volume from there. One of the things I've noticed talking to like really, really strong lifters, and this is true for myself as well, like the level of training volume that works best for me now currently is quite a bit lower than it was when I was quite a bit weaker. And I think that's just because like the amount of stimulus I'm capable of exposing myself to and the amount of stress I'm capable of putting on my body on a per set basis is just a lot higher than it used to be when I wasn't as strong as I am now. And that's not the case for every really strong person I know, but it seems to be the case for like a non-negligible number of them. And so I one would push back against just the progression of volume over time for everyone in all situations, period. And two, like those general changes in optimal volume levels, in my experience, seem to take place on the time scale of years or maybe months, certainly not weeks.
Yeah, I think another thing from a practical perspective is I know that a lot of my clients they're very busy and they like training, so they don't like short workouts, but they also, like I said, they're busy, so they don't like workouts that drag on and on and on. And so as set number, if there's really large fluctuations in set number from week to week across the course of a mesocycle, I know that many of my clients would frankly be annoyed by the variation in the duration of workouts as you kind of climbed up from very few sets to a large number of sets per workout. So like just having the duration of the workout be a little bit more fixed and a little bit more reliable and predictable from workout to workout and week to week, I think a lot of people practically enjoy that as a feature of a program.
And, you know, when you mentioned there's a lot of exercises, you know, when you get into accessory work where each incremental jump is big, you know, and so you're like, well, we can't just add another increment in weight because we're not ready for that yet. And man, that was never more true than when every gym in the world shut down. all of a sudden, a lot of my clients said like, all right, Eric, you know, good news, I have a home gym. Bad news, I've got three dumbbells. You know what I mean? Yeah. And so like, it was like, okay,
I've got two sets. I've got some 30s and some 70s.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's like, okay, are we ready to jump from 30 to 70? Probably not yet. And so it kind of made me get creative with, you know, how are we going to continue bumping this along without making a jump in the weight we're using? And in the response paper, Brian Miner and colleagues kind of laid out a double progression method where it's like, okay, well, let's use that fixed load. Let's keep bumping reps up with a particular reps in reserve target. And once we're hitting a large number of reps with that given proximity to failure, now we know, okay, let's bump up the load and drop down to the lower end of our acceptable repetition range. So using things like that has been really helpful, or rather than just saying, well, let's add another set on, I would say, well, let's get some more reps this week, but maintain our proximity to failure and adjust things that way. And eventually we can kind of bump things up, you know, even though we have a limited number of options in terms of loading. So yeah, I mean, you know, I of course, anyone that puts together a program at some point is going to fluctuate the number of sets that exists in the program. But I'm definitely more inclined to do that block to block or mesocycle to mesocycle rather than within mesocycle. You know, if we're getting to the point where I'm like, okay, we need to make a relatively large incremental jump up in our volume, I'll probably add that at the beginning of the next mesocycle and kind of ease into that higher volume as we go.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. I think people will be satisfied with that response, Greg. I think you made your thoughts known. That's useful. Practical stuff.
Cool. Okay. Can we do one Q&A? I really want to do the Wilk score one.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see here. Is this the... Yeah.
It's Kenny.
Yeah. Kenny asked this. So the other day I was looking at the outline and the only thing I saw was a specific line that said, let's assume Paul Rudd is an average power lifter. And I was like, what are you responding to? So Kenny asks, can you calculate or estimate, based on evidence in the documentary film Ant-Man, what Ant-Man's Wilk score would be? And is Ant-Man's Wilk score achievable as a natural lifter?
Yeah, so that is a great question, which is why...
Everybody's been thinking it, so yeah, somebody had to ask
No, for sure. And I appreciate Kenny's intellectual curiosity and bravery for being willing to ask this question. So yeah, I love this question, which is why I wanted to shoehorn it into this episode. And there's levels to this. So the first thing to keep in mind is that Ant-Man, I think canonically, like how his power is supposed to work, is that he's able to shrink or grow, but like basically his strength doesn't change as he shrinks or grows. So like he can be the size of an ant and still be as strong as a normal sized man. Conversely, when he grows really, really big, he seems weak and moves very sluggishly because, you know, he now has way more mass because he's much larger, but he's not any stronger than he was when he was normal size. Like I'm pretty sure that's how Ant-Man's power set works. And so the room temperature IQ way of approaching this question is being like, okay, well, Wilkes is essentially like a very, very complex, like fifth order polynomial strength to body weight ratio. Lighter people have higher Wilkes scores if their total is the same. Therefore, Ant-Man could shrink and shrink and shrink. His mass would get smaller and smaller, tending towards zero. And therefore, his Wilkes score could be infinite if he was still capable of like lifting a bar any distance whatsoever. Like I said, that is the room temperature IQ way of approaching this question because it completely misunderstands how the Wilk score works. So, Wilk's score is kind of like a fancy strength to body weight ratio, but the difference between Wilk's score and strength to body weight ratios is that the y-intercept of the Wilk's formula is not at zero. So, at zero body weight, or like as you approach zero body mass, it doesn't actually like keep getting lower and lower and lower. So the normal IQ way of approaching this would be to say like, okay, well, let's get the fifth order polynomial that defines a Wilk score. Let's plot it. And then let's see if there are any vertical asymptotes, which there are. There are two vertical asymptotes at kind of not completely ridiculous body weights, I guess. So one is a vertical asymptote at a body weight slightly below 13.5 kilos, and the other is a vertical asymptote slightly above 283 kilos. And so you could look at that and say like, hey, there is a perfect body mass that he could shrink himself down to, and then no matter what he lifted at that body mass, his Wilk score would be virtually infinite. So yeah, like that seems like it makes sense. But like I said, that's the normal IQ. Here's the galaxy brain approach, which actually knows how Wilk's functions. So if you go to like, if you just go to the Wikipedia page for Wilk score, it'll give you the coefficients to plot the fifth order polynomial that like defines the Wilk's coefficients, but that's not actually how Wilk's score is calculated. The actual real legit Wilk's score is literally just a table of coefficients, and that is what Wilk's score is. And so it goes from 40 to 205 kilos for male lifters. And so if you're a male lifter and you're less than 40 kilos, you don't plug it into the formula, the fifth order polynomial, to get it. You just assume that whoever it is weighs exactly 40 kilos. Anyone under 40 kilos is 40 kilos for all intents and purposes for Wilk's. And anyone above 205 kilos is exactly 205 kilos for the purposes of Wilk's. So that's how it actually functions. The formula doesn't fucking matter. It's literally just the table of coefficients, and that is Wilk's. And so the best that Paul Rudd could actually do, or Ant-Man, is he could shrink down such that his body mass is 40 kilos and then just lift what he lifts. And that is the best his Wilk score could possibly be. And so the line that Eric was referring to in the outline is, let's assume Paul Rudd is a more or less average male powerlifter. And so somewhere around the median performance for male powerlifters is a squat around 200 kilos, bench around 150, deadlift around 250. So a total of about 600 kilos. If you totaled 600 kilos at a body mass of 40 kilos, your Wilk score would be about 801. And so that's like the original Wilk's. I know there was a new Wilk's formula that came out this year. No one fucking uses it. The IPF has moved on. I think like the one federation in Australia that Wilk's himself is still associated with uses the new Wilk's formula. Who gives a shit? The Wilk's that everyone knows, and I would say loves, but I think everyone hated it, is like the older version of the formula. So that's what we're going with. So with that version,
you hate it, but it's familiar.
Correct. Yeah. So with that version of the formula, his Wilk's would be about 801. The best Wilk's ever by anyone competing raw was Mariana Gasparian. So her Wilk's was 720. And the best Wilk's score ever in a drug-tested meet was Andre Stanazic at 598. So to answer Kenny's question, what would the Wilk's score be and is it achievable, Natty? Probably around 801, assuming he's more or less average. And I don't think that that's achievable, Natty. The thing is, like, I'm generally pretty optimistic about the progression of the sport of powerlifting. Like, it's the best lifters have gotten a lot better over the last decade. I think that there's still probably room to improve, but for the best tested Wilk's to go from like right at 600 to right at 800, that would entail the assumption that lifters can get about a third better than they currently are. And I really just don't see that happening. It may happen. Maybe I'm a pessimist. I have been on the optimistic side of things as far as the progression of the sport has gone up to this point. I just don't see the top lifters getting a full third better than they currently are. So, no, I do not think Ant-Man's Wilk score would be achievable natty.
So now everybody can stop asking.
Right.
It's every week I'm getting this question.
Yeah, stop blowing my inbox up about that. However, if you want me to stay on as a permanent co-host of this show, you should blow up Eric's inbox asking him to keep me on. If 100 people message him before the next episode comes, I will stay on and be promoted to permanent co-host. We talked about this before we started recording. If 100 people don't message him, I will be kicked off the podcast permanently, and do what everyone has been expecting me to do this whole time, which is raise a guerrilla army and lay siege to the Netherlands. So those are your options if you're listening to this.
A quick correction. It's not messages before the next episode. It's the messages have to get in before October 7th. That's the date.
So before this episode comes out.
Listen, that's 5 days. Make it happen. All right. So to play us out, we are at the end of the episode here. It's October. We're recording this on October 2nd. October means Big Ten football is back in about 3 weeks here. And if football's back, it means barbecue is on. So to play us out, we've got some barbecue tips. I'm going to go first because you don't want to miss what I've got to say about this. People ask me for cooking tips all the time. So first of all, I'm just going to make a controversial statement that is actually a fact. Eastern Carolina barbecue sauce is the best version of barbecue sauce.
Is that vinegar-based or mustard-based?
Heavy vinegar, okay. Some black pepper in there.
Because both of those are Eastern North Carolina barbecue sauces.
I like the mustard one, too. I've been getting a lot of barbecue sauce at the grocery store for my shredded chicken. A big surprise. It's going on shredded chicken, everybody. But yeah, the super vinegar-based with some black pepper is amazing. And then the equally vinegar-based with some mustard in it is also a beautiful thing. People argue about other kinds of barbecue styles that are, they're very good, but the Eastern Carolina barbecue, in terms of sauces, you just can't beat it. Now, here's what I've been doing. For people who are keeping an eye on their macros a little bit, my coleslaw recipe, out of this world. So you go get the actual like vegetable mix for coleslaw, which is just a bunch of chopped up cabbage, a little bit of carrot in there. But it's just like getting a bag of salad greens, you know, at the grocery store. So I get the vegetables all chopped up, ready to go, put them in a bowl. Here's what you put in. You put in Greek yogurt, mix that in there. And you put in just a little bit of Dijon mustard and a little bit of Splenda. You got a little bit of tangy, a little bit of sweet. You mix it all up. It's really good coleslaw. And that's all I got. Get some shredded chicken in there. Throw some sauce on it. You're good to go.
No salt?
No, because I eat it all in a big combination. So the barbecue sauce is a little bit salty.
I gotcha.
Yeah. It's good stuff, man.
Sure. I mean, honestly, as far as like macro-friendly stuff goes, that sounds fine. If you ever wanted to thin it out a little bit, like throwing a splash of apple cider vinegar in there would probably be pretty good.
Yeah, I might try that.
Cool. Okay, so my barbecue tip is for anyone who wants to make like a pretty adequate rack of ribs indoors. So it's not that hard to smoke ribs as long as you can control the temperature of your smoker reasonably well. Decent smoked ribs are trivially easy. But I know a lot of people either don't have a smoker or like you live in an apartment, and so like that's just logistically not feasible. And so if you want something that isn't going to replace good smoked ribs but at least comes reasonably close, that you can do indoors in your kitchen, here is a good option. So first thing, I'd strongly, strongly recommend using a sous vide circulator if you can afford one. If you can't, you can do it without it, but sous vide makes it easier and the resulting ribs will be juicier. But I'll give you tips for whether or not you have the sous vide circulator. So to start with, I'm a big fan of brining pretty much any meat, and ribs are no exception. So I think good ribs start with a good brine if you have the time to do so. So just make a 2% salt solution. Brine your ribs overnight in that salt solution and put it in a relatively shallow container so that it doesn't need as much brine to cover the ribs. And then here's the important part. So they make like cheap smoking contraptions that you can either use like on your countertop or in your oven. And all of those just seem to me to be like more trouble than they're actually worth. A very simple solution to getting something that tastes smoky that you don't actually have to smoke is just using liquid smoke, which isn't as good as just like regular ass smoke. And I know people throw shade on liquid smoke, but like, honestly, it's fine. Like if you want to get that smoky flavor, and especially if we're talking about ribs, which you're probably going to be applying a dry rub to and maybe some sauce, it's not as noticeable that it's liquid smoke. So, you know, if you just want like smoky bacon and it's the difference between like actually smoking it and the only other flavor going on is just salt, it's going to be fucking obvious that you use liquid smoke. But for ribs, like you can honestly get away with it. So add some liquid smoke to your brine that you're going to be soaking the ribs in, and add a little bit more than you think you need. So mix some in, sniff it. When it smells a little smokier than you think it needs to smell, it's probably pretty good. And the reason you want to get it a little too smoky is it's not going to get like super, super deep into the ribs. So anyway, you get your smoky brine, 2% salt solution, soak the ribs overnight. And then the next day, if you're using sous vide, what you would then do is take the ribs out of the brine, pat them dry, apply a dry rub. I personally prefer to use just plain yellow mustard as a binder. You can use whatever you want. And for your dry rub, I'd either recommend no salt in it since you've already brined the ribs, or just very, very light salt, because if you are brining your ribs beforehand, they could wind up too salty if you use a salty dry rub. You go ahead and apply your dry rub, put it in a sous vide bag, and sous vide at 165 degrees Fahrenheit for about 10 to 12 hours. That'll get you some nice soft ribs that aren't just like completely falling apart. And then once that's done, you remove from the bag, you apply some sauce or glaze if you so choose, or, you know, you can just leave them with only the dry rub. Pop them in a really hot oven. So at least 450 degrees Fahrenheit, or if you're going to be watching them pretty close, just you can go ahead and pop them under a broiler. And all that's going to do is like really get everything nice and bubbly. If you apply to sauce or glaze, that's going to help it set. If you do use a broiler, be really, really careful of burning, especially if there was sugar in your dry rub or sauce, because if the sugar burns and like actually turns black, it's going to be super bitter and taste like shit. But yeah, so that's if you're sous videing. If you don't have a sous vide system, that's totally fine. Once you've brined the ribs overnight, same process, pat it dry, apply your dry rub, and then bake at a low temperature, almost as if you were smoking. So like maybe 250 degrees, and just temp it every so often. So ribs, like you don't want medium ribs. That's going to be a problem. There's going to be a lot of unrendered fat. There's going to be a lot of connective tissue that hasn't broken down yet. So you want to get your ribs up to about 165, 170, give or take. But yeah, just keep it in a low oven until you reach that internal temperature, and then exact same process as before. Crank the temperature up, apply your sauce and or glaze if that's what you're using, get everything nice and bubbly and sizzly, and they'll be pretty decent ribs. Again, not as good as legit smoked ribs, but not a terrible simulacrum to be able to make indoors in a kitchen.
All right, and always, when you make those ribs, put a little bit of the old Trexler coleslaw on the side of the plate. It's going to go well perfectly together. Okay, so that does it for our first episode back from summer break. Before we leave, I want to remind you to join in on the Stronger by Science conversation by going to the Facebook group or the subreddit. And again, the Facebook group is called the Stronger by Science community. So along those lines, be sure to be a good member of those communities. Be kind to each other. Be helpful to each other. Greg and I are going to have a presence there. The other Stronger by Science coaches are also going to have a presence there. So it's a great place to discuss all things Stronger by Science and really just all things training and nutrition in general. You know, Greg and I get a lot of direct messages with questions about training and nutrition. And of course, we're happy to receive those, happy to answer them. But they're generally really good questions, and other people benefit from seeing those interactions and joining in on those conversations themselves. So be sure to check out those online communities, and we will see you there. As always, thank you for listening to the Stronger by Science podcast, and we will be back with our next episode in 2 weeks. Thank you for listening to the Stronger by Science podcast. If you enjoyed the podcast, be sure to sign up for our free newsletter to get concise breakdowns of relevant research, as well as 28 free training programs for all skill levels and all schedules. We hate spam just as much as you do, so we'll only email you when we have something really interesting to share with you. You can sign up for the free newsletter at strongerbyscience.com/newsletter, or just go to the Stronger by Science homepage and click the free programs button at the top. If you want to join in on the Stronger by Science podcast conversation, be sure to check out our Facebook group and our subreddit. The links for both are provided in the description of today's episode. Finally, please remember that we are not medical doctors or registered dietitians. So, before you make any changes to your exercise or nutrition habits, be sure to check with a qualified healthcare professional. Once again, thank you for listening, and we will be back soon with another episode of the Stronger by Science podcast.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.